This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Love and Its Meaning in the World. This is part 9. The title of this lecture is Faith, Love, and Hope, part 2. Given on December 3rd, 1911 in Nuremberg, and is from the book Faith, Love, and Hope. Yesterday we tried to assess the importance in human life of what may be called the supersensible revelation of our time. We suggested that this revelation was to be considered the third in the most recent cycle of humanity, and that it should, in a certain sense, be regarded as sequential to the Sinai revelation and the revelation at the time of the mystery of Golgotha. We should not think that this aspect of our age merely has theoretical or scientific effect on us. As anthroposophists, we must rise to an ever fuller realization that human beings are neglecting something essential in their evolution by remaining aloof from everything announced to us now and in the future. It is certainly befitting that the external world should initially pass this by and even treat it as pure fantasy. And it is quite natural as well that many people would at first ignore the harmful consequences of disregarding what is here in question. Anthroposophists, however, should be clear that the souls now dwelling in human bodies, regardless of what they absorb at present, are approaching a certain future. What I have to say concerns every soul, for it is part of the whole trend of change in our time. Souls incarnated today have only recently advanced to the stage of genuine eye consciousness. This has been in preparation during the course of evolution since the old Atlantean period. From those ancient days until the time of the great change intimated by the mystery of Golgotha, this eye consciousness was gradually liberating itself from a consciousness no longer really known by contemporary human beings. Today, people typically distinguish only between the ordinary state of wakefulness and that of sleep, when consciousness is completely suspended. Between these conditions, people also recognize the intermediate state of dreaming. From a modern perspective, however, this is regarded only as a kind of aberration or departure from the norm. Through dream images, certain events from the depths of the soul life rise into consciousness, but in ordinary dreaming they emerge in such an obscure form that the dreamer is seldom able to interpret correctly their very real relationship to deep supersensible processes in the soul's life. In order to grasp one characteristic feature of this intermediate state, a state well understood in earlier times, let us take an ordinary dream, which has been made a regular riddle by modern scientific investigators of dreams, who can only interpret it superficially and materialistically. A highly significant dream, you see. I am taking my example from the science of dreams, which, as I mentioned before, today has been given a place, little understood though it is, among sciences such as chemistry and physics. The following dream, one that is characteristic, has been recorded. I might easily have taken my example from similar unpublished dreams, but I want to deal with one that raises certain problems for modern commentators with no key to such matters. The case is this. A married couple had a much beloved son and were enjoying his growth. One day he became ill and his condition grew worse within a few hours, to the degree that by the end of that day he passed through the gate of death. Consequently, the couple's ordinary experience was that their son was snatched from them abruptly, torn from a life full of promise. Of course, the parents mourned for their son. During the following months, both parents had quite a few dreams that reminded them of him. But one night, after quite a long time, many months after his death, the boy's father and mother had exactly the same dream. They dreamt that their son had appeared to them and told them he had been buried alive, having only been in a trance, and that they merely had to look into the matter to be convinced that this was true. The parents told each other that they had dreamt on the same night, and their attitude to life was such that they immediately asked the authorities for permission to have their son's body disinterred. The request was refused, however, which gave the parents even more cause for grief. The investigator, who gave his account of the dream, could think of it only in a materialistic way, and he was faced with great difficulties. His final explanation is quite remarkable, and bound to seem contrived to anyone who reads it. He said, "We have to assume that one parent had the dream, and the other, hearing it while awake, got the idea that he or she had dreamt it as well. To contemporary consciousness, this interpretation initially seems fairly obvious, but it doesn't go very deep." I have specifically mentioned that for anyone well versed in dream experiences, it is not unusual for several people to have the same dream at the same time. Let us try now to look into this dream experience from the perspective of spiritual science. The results of spiritual investigation show how one who has gone through the gate of death lives on as an individual in the spiritual world. We also know that there are definite connections between everything and every being in the world, and that this is shown by the link that unites those who have departed with people still on earth who lovingly concentrate thoughts on their dead. There is no doubt that there is a connection between those on the physical plane and those who have left it for the supersensible world. There is always a connection whenever those left on the physical plane turn their thoughts to the dead, a connection that may continue even when their thoughts are directed elsewhere. The point is this: human beings, as they are organized for life on the physical plane, cannot become conscious of these bonds while awake. Lacking knowledge of a thing, however, does not justify a denial of its existence. Such a conclusion would be very superficial. On that basis, those now sitting in this room and not seeing Nuremberg could easily prove there is no such place. So we must be clear that it is only because of their present-day organization that human beings know nothing of their connection with the dead. Nevertheless, it exists. However, knowledge of what is going on in the depths of the soul can occasionally be conjured up into consciousness, and this happens in dreams. It is one thing we have to reckon with when considering dream experiences. Another thing is the knowledge that passing through death is not the sudden leap imagined by those who know nothing about it. It is a gradual transition. What occupies a soul here on earth does not then vanish in a moment. What a person loves, he or she continues to love after death. But there is then no possibility of satisfying a feeling that depends for its satisfaction on a physical body. The wishes and desires of the soul, its joys and sorrows, the particular tendencies it has during incarnation in the physical body, these naturally continue even when the gate of death has been passed. We can therefore understand the strength of the feeling in this young man, meeting with death when quite unprepared, that he would like to be still on earth, and how keen was his longing to be in a physical body. This desire, working as a force in the soul, lasted for a long, long time during his Kamaloka. Now picture vividly to yourselves the parents, with their thoughts engrossed by this beloved dead son. Even in sleep the connecting links were there. Just at the moment when both father and mother began to dream, the son, in accordance with the state of his soul, had a particularly keen desire that we may perhaps clothe in these words, "Oh, if only I were still on earth in a physical body." This thought from the dead son sank deep into his parents' souls, but they had no special faculty for understanding what lay behind the dream. Thus the imprint of the thought on their soul life was transformed into familiar images. If they could have clearly perceived what the son was pouring into their souls, their interpretation would have been, "Our son is longing just now for a physical body." In fact, the dream image clothed itself in words that they could understand. "He has been buried alive," which hid the truth from them. Thus, in dream pictures of this kind, we should not look for an exact replica of what is real in the spiritual worlds. We must expect the actual objective occurrence to be veiled according to the dreamer's degree of understanding. Today it is the peculiar feature of the dream world that if we are unable to go into these matters more deeply, we can no longer regard its pictures as faithful copies of what underlies them. We are obliged to say that something is always living in our soul, behind the dream picture, and that the picture can be looked upon only as an even greater illusion than the external world confronting us when we are awake. It is only in our time that dreams are appearing to people in this guise, strictly speaking, only since the events in Palestine, when I consciousness took on the form it has now. Before then, the pictures appeared while people were in a state different from either waking or sleeping, a third state, more like the one prevailing in the supersensible world. Human beings lived with the dead in spirit far more than is feasible now. There is no need to look back many centuries before the Christian era to realize what a countless number of people were then able to say. The dead are certainly not dead. They are living in the supersensible world. I can perceive what they are feeling and seeing, what they now actually are. This holds good also for the other beings in the supersensible world, for instance, those we know as the hierarchies. Thus human beings once had these experiences in certain states between waking and sleeping, and the last degenerate echoes linger on in dreams. It was very important that humans should feel this disappearance of something they once possessed. In the traditional epoch of human evolution, when the great events were taking place in Palestine, there was indeed cause for saying, "Change your mood of soul, quite different times are coming for humankind." And among the changes was this, that the old possibility of seeing into the spiritual world, of personally experiencing how matters stood with the dead and with all other spiritual beings, was going to pass away. The history of these bygone days offers ample evidence of this living with the dead, notably in the religious veneration that arose everywhere in the form of ancestor worship. This was founded on belief in the reality and activity of those who had died, which continued almost everywhere during the transitional period. Human experience was this, though perhaps not put clearly into words. Formerly our souls could rise to the world we call the spirit world, and we were able to dwell among the higher beings and with the dead. But now our dead leave us in quite another sense. They disappear from our consciousness, and the old vivid contact is no more. We come here to something exceptionally difficult to grasp, but the intelligent mind, the intelligent soul, can learn to do so. Those who felt most vividly the loss of direct psychic contact with the dead were the early Christians, and this was what made their worship of God so full of meaning, so infinitely deep and holy. They compensated for what was lost by the reverent feeling they brought to their religious ceremonies, for instance, when they sacrificed at the graves of their dead, or celebrated the Mass, or observed any other religious rite. In fact, it was during this period of transition, when consciousness of the dead was seen to be wanting, that altars took the shape of coffins. Thus it was with this kind of feeling for mortal remains, unlike that of the ancient Egyptians, that the service of God, the service of the Spirit, was reverently performed. As I have said, this is something not easy to understand. However, we need only observe the form of an altar and allow our hearts to respond to this gradual change in the whole outlook of humanity, and then feeling and understanding will arise for the change and its consequences. We see, therefore, that slowly, gradually, the present state of the human soul was brought about. From indications given yesterday, it can be gathered that what has thus come into being will again be succeeded by a different state for which people are already developing faculties. The example I gave yesterday of how people will see in a kind of dream picture their future karmic compensation for some deed means the reawakening of faculties that will lead the soul once more to the spiritual worlds. In relation to earthly evolution as a whole, the intermediate state, when the soul has been cut off from the supersensible world, will prove to be comparatively short. It had to come about for human beings to be able to acquire the strongest possible forces for their freedom. But something else I have spoken of was bound up with the whole progress of human evolution. Only in this way were human beings able to acquire a feeling of the I capital within them, to have the right I consciousness. The farther human beings advance into the future, the more firmly will this I consciousness establish itself within them, always increasing in significance. In other words, the force and self-sufficiency of human individuality will be increasingly accentuated, so that it becomes necessary for human beings to find in themselves their own effective support. Thus we see that the I consciousness human beings have today does not go back as far as is usually imagined. Only a few incarnations ago, humans did not have the I feeling that is characteristic of them today. And since the I feeling is intimately connected with memory, we need not be surprised that many people have not yet begun to look back on their previous incarnations. Because of the undeveloped state of this feeling for the I during early childhood, people do not even remember what happened to them then. So it seems quite comprehensible that for the same reasons, they are unable yet to remember their earlier incarnations. But now, we have come to the point when human beings have developed a feeling for their I, and the forces are unfolding that will make it necessary in our coming incarnations to remember those that have gone before. The days are drawing near when people will feel bound to admit, we have strange glimpses into the past, when we were already on the earth but living in another bodily form. We look back and have to say that we were already then on earth. And among the faculties appearing more and more in human beings will be one that arouses the feeling, it can only be that I am looking back on my earlier incarnations. Just think how in the human souls now on earth, the inner force is already arising that will enable them to look back in their next incarnations and recognize themselves. But for those who have not become familiar with the idea of reincarnation, this looking back will be a veritable torment. Ignorance of the mysteries of repeated earthly lives will be actually painful for these human beings. Forces in them are striving to rise and bear witness to earlier times. But this cannot happen because all knowledge of those forces is refused. Not to learn of the truths now being proclaimed through spiritual science does not mean neglecting mere theories. It is on the way to making a torment of life in future incarnations. Accordingly, something is happening in these times of transition. The slow preparation for it can be gathered from our second mystery play titled The Soul's Probation. Aside by the reader, this is available on the website, end of my aside, where earlier incarnations of the characters are portrayed, incarnations of only a few centuries before. The event was then already in preparation, and now, thanks to the wisdom of cosmic guidance, human beings will be given positive opportunities to make themselves familiar with the truths of the mysteries. At present, comparatively few find their way to spiritual science. Their number is modest compared with the rest of humankind. It may be said that interest in anthroposophy is not yet very widespread, but in our age the law of reincarnation is such that those now going through the world apathetically, ignoring what experience can tell about the need for exploring the riddles of life, will incarnate again in a relatively short time, and thus have ample opportunity for absorbing the truths of spiritual science. That is how it stands. So, when perhaps we see around us people we esteem, people we love, who will have nothing to do with anthroposophy, or even hostile toward it, we ought not to take it too much to heart. It is perfectly true, and should be realized by anthroposophists, that refusing to look into spiritual science or anthroposophy means preparing a life of torment for future incarnations on earth. That is true, and should not be treated lightly. On the other hand, those who see friends and acquaintances they care for, showing no inclination toward anthroposophy, can think, if I become a good anthroposophist myself, I will find an early opportunity, with the forces remaining to me after death, to prove helpful to these souls, provided the living link we have spoken of is there. And because the interval between death and rebirth is becoming shorter, these souls too will have the opportunity of absorbing the mystery truths that must be absorbed if torment is to be avoided in future human incarnations. All is not yet lost. Therefore, we have to look upon anthroposophy as a real power. Yet, on the other hand, we must not be duly grieved or pessimistic about the matter. It would be mistaken optimism to say, if that is how things are, I need not accept the truths of spiritual science till my next incarnation. If everyone were to say that, there would be too few opportunities for effective aid to be given when the next incarnations gradually come. Even if those wishing for anthroposophy can now receive its truths from only a very few people, the situation will be different for the countless hosts who, in a comparatively short time, will be eagerly turning to it. A countless number of anthroposophists will then be needed to make these truths known, either here on the physical plane, or, if they are not incarnated, from higher planes. That is one thing we must learn from the whole character of the great change now taking place. The other is that all this has to be experienced by the I, so that it will rely increasingly upon itself, becoming more and more independent. The self-reliance of the I must come for all souls, but it will mean disaster for those who make no effort to learn about the great spiritual truths, for they will feel the increasing individualism as isolation. On the other hand, those who have made themselves familiar with the deep mysteries of the spiritual world will thereby find a way to forge ever stronger spiritual bonds between souls. Old bonds will be loosened, new ones formed. All this is imminent, but it will be gradual. We are living at present in the fifth post-Atlantean period, which will be followed by a sixth, and then by a seventh, when a catastrophe will come upon us, just as one came between the Atlantean and post-Atlantean periods. When the lectures on the apocalypse were given here in Nuremberg, you heard a description of this coming catastrophe, of how it will resemble and how it will differ from the one in old Atlantis. If we observe life around us, we might express the particular feature of our age in this way. The most active element in human beings today is their intellectualism, their intellectual conception of the world. We are living together in an age of intellectualism. It has been brought about through quite special circumstances, and we will come to understand these if we look back to the time before our present fifth post-Atlantean cultural epoch, the Greco-Latin, as it is called. That was the remarkable period when human beings had not reached their present state of detachment from the manifestations of nature and knowledge of the world. But at the same time, it was the epoch when the I descended among humankind. The Christ event had also to happen in that epoch, because with him the I made its descent in a special way. What then is our present experience? It is not just of the entry of the I. We now experience how one of our sheaths casts a kind of reflection upon the soul. The sheath that yesterday we called the faith body throws its reflection onto the human soul in this fifth epoch. Thus it is a feature of present-day humanity that we have something in the soul that is, as it were, a reflection of the faith nature of the astral body. In the sixth post-Atlantean epoch, there will be a reflection within human beings of the love nature of the etheric body, and in the seventh, before the great catastrophe, the reflection of the hope nature of the physical body. For those who have heard lectures I am now giving in various places, I would note that these gradual happenings have been described from a different perspective, both in Munich and in Stuttgart. Footnote: Steiner was currently presenting the course of lectures Esoteric Christianity and the Mission of Christian Rosenkreuz. End of footnote. The theme, however, is always the same. What is now being portrayed in connection with the three great human forces, faith, love, and hope, was there represented in direct relation to the elements in a human life of soul. but it is all the same thing. I have done this intentionally, so that anthroposophists may grow accustomed to getting the gist of a matter without strict adherence to special words. When we realize that things can be described from many different sides, we will no longer pin so much faith on words and will focus our efforts on the matter itself, knowing that any description amounts to only an approximation of the whole truth. Adherence to the original words is the last thing that can help us get to the heart of a matter. The one helpful means is to harmonize what has been said in successive lectures. Just as we learn about a tree by studying it not from one direction only, but from many different aspects. Thus the essential characteristic of our time is the force of faith of the astral body that is shining into the soul. Someone might say, "That is rather strange. You are telling us now that the ruling force of the age is faith." We might admit this is the case for those who hold to old beliefs. But today so many people are too mature for that, and they look down on such old beliefs as belonging to the childish stage of human evolution. It may well be that people who say they are monists believe they do not believe, but actually they are more ready to believe than those calling themselves believers. For though monists are not conscious of it, all that we see in the various forms of monism is belief of the most blind kind, which monists believe to be knowledge. We cannot describe their doings at all without mentioning belief, and quite apart from the belief of those who believe they do not believe, we find that, strictly speaking, an endless amount of what is most important today is connected with the reflection the astral body throws into the soul, giving it the character of ardent faith. We have only to call to mind lives of the great people of our age. For example, Richard Wagner, even as an artist, was rising all his life to a definite faith. It is fascinating to watch this in the development of his personality. Everywhere we look today, the lights and shadows can be interpreted as the reflection of faith in what we may call the human I-soul. Our age will be followed by one in which the need for love will cast its light. Love in the sixth cultural epoch will show itself in a very different form, different even from what can be called Christian love. Slowly we draw nearer to that epoch, and by making those in the anthroposophical movement familiar with the mysteries of the cosmos, with the nature of the various individualities, both on the physical plane and on the higher planes, we try to kindle love for everything in existence. This is not done so much by talking of love, as by feeling that what is able to kindle love in the soul is prepared for the sixth epoch by anthroposophy. Through anthroposophy, the forces of love are especially aroused in the whole human soul, and what a person needs is prepared for by gradually acquiring a true understanding of the mystery of Golgotha. For it is indeed true that the mystery of Golgotha came to pass, and the Gospels have evoked something that yesterday was likened to how children learn to speak. But the deepest lesson, the mission of earthly love in its connection with the mystery of Golgotha, has not yet been grasped. Full understanding of this will be possible only in the sixth post-Atlantean cultural epoch, when people grow to realize more and more that its foundations are actually within them and out of their innermost being. In other words, out of love, do what should be done. Then the guidance of the Ten Commandments will have been outlived, and the stage reached that is described in Goethe's words, duty, when one loves the commands one gives to oneself. When forces wake in our souls that impel us to do what we should through love alone, we discover in us something that must gradually become widespread in the sixth cultural epoch. Then special forces of the etheric body will make themselves known in a person's nature. To understand what it is that must increasingly come about in this way, we have to consider it from two sides. One side has certainly not come yet. It is only dreamt of by the most advanced in spirit. It is a well-defined relation between custom, morals, ethics, and the understanding, intellectuality. Today a person may be to a certain extent a rascal, yet at the same time intelligent and clever. Some people may even use their very cleverness to further their knavery. At present, people are not required to combine their intelligence with an equal degree of morality. To all we have been anticipating for the future, it must be added that as we advance, it will no longer be possible for these two qualities of the human soul to be kept apart or to exist in unequal measure. Those who, according to the reckoning of their previous incarnation, have become particularly intelligent without being moral, will in their new incarnation possess only a stunted intelligence. To have equal amounts of intelligence and morality in future incarnations, they will be obliged, as a consequence of universal cosmic law, to enter their new incarnation with a crippled intelligence, so that immorality and stupidity coincide. For immorality has a crippling effect upon intelligence. In other words, we are approaching the age when morality, and what has now been described for the sixth post-Atlantean epoch as the shining into the eye-soul of the love forces of the etheric body, point essentially to forces having to do with harmonizing those of intelligence and morality. That is the one side to be considered. The other side is that it is solely through harmony of this kind, between morality, custom, and intelligence, that the whole depth of the mystery of Golgotha is to be grasped. This will come about only through the individuality who, before Christ Jesus came to earth, prepared human beings for that mystery, developing in his successive incarnations ever greater powers as teacher of the greatest of all earthly events. This individuality, whom in his rank as Bodhisattva we call the successor of Gautama Buddha, was incarnated in the personality living about 100 years before Christ, under the name of Jeshu Ben Pandira. Among his many students was one who had, at that time, already in a certain sense, written down a prophetic version of the Matthew Gospel, and this, after the mystery of Golgotha had been enacted, needed only to be given a new form. There have been and will continue to be frequent incarnations of the individuality who appeared as Jeshu Ben Pandira, until he rises from the rank of Bodhisattva to that of Buddha. According to our reckoning of time, this will be in about 3,000 years. Then a sufficient number of people will possess the above-mentioned faculties. And in the course of a remarkable incarnation, this great teacher of humankind will be able to interpret the mystery of Golgotha in a very different way from what is possible today. It is true that even today a seer into the supersensible worlds can gain some idea of what is to happen then, but the ordinary earthly organization of the human being cannot yet provide a physical body capable of doing what that teacher will be able to do approximately 3,000 years hence. There is as yet no human language through which verbal teaching could exert the magical effects that will spring from the words of that great teacher of humanity. His words will flow directly to the hearts of human beings, into their souls, like a healing medicine. Nothing in those words will be merely theoretical. At the same time, the teaching will contain, to an extent far greater than can be conceived today, a magical moral force, carrying to hearts and souls a full conviction of the eternal, deeply significant communion of intellect and morality. This great teacher, who will be able to give to human beings ripe for it the most profound instruction concerning the nature of the mystery of Golgotha, will fulfill what Oriental prophets have always said, that the true successor of Buddha would be, for all humankind, the greatest teacher of the good. For that reason he has been called in Oriental tradition the Maitreya Buddha. His task will be to enlighten human beings concerning the mystery of Golgotha. And for this he will draw ideas and words of the deepest significance from the very language he will use. No human language today can evoke any conception of it. His words will imprint into human souls directly, magically, the nature of the mystery of Golgotha. In this connection also, we are approaching what we may call the future moral age of humankind. In a certain sense, we could designate it as a coming golden age. Even today, however, speaking from the ground of anthroposophy. We point in full consciousness to what is destined to come about, how the Christ will gradually reveal himself to ever higher powers in human beings, and how the teachers who up to now have taught only individual peoples and individual human beings will become the interpreters of the great Christ event for all who are willing to listen. And we can point out how, through the dawning of the age of love, conditions for the age of morality are prepared. Then will come the last epoch, during which human souls will receive the reflection of what we call hope, when strengthened through the force flowing from the mystery of Golgotha and from the age of morality, human beings will take into themselves forces of hope. This is the most important gift they need in order to face the next catastrophe and to begin new life, just as was done in this present post-Atlantean age. When in the final post-Atlantean epoch our external culture, with its tendency to calculation, will have come to a climax that brings no feeling of satisfaction, but leaves those who have not developed the spiritual within them to confront their culture in utter desolation, then out of spirituality the seed of hope will be sown, and in the next period of human evolution it will grow to maturity. If the spirit is denied all possibility of imparting to human souls what it can give, and what the anthroposophical movement has the will to convey, this external culture might for a short while be able to hold its own. Ultimately, however, people will ask themselves what they have gained, and say, we have wireless installations, undreamt of by our ancestors, to transmit our thoughts all over the earth, and what good does it do us? The most trivial, unproductive thoughts are sent hither and thither, and human ingenuity has to be strained to the utmost to enable us to travel at high speeds around the globe or to transport something for us to eat from some far distant region using all kinds of perfected appliances. But there is nothing in our heads worth sending from place to place, for our thoughts are cheerless. Moreover, since we have had our present means of communication, they have become even more cheerless than when they were conveyed in the old snail-like fashion. In short, despair and desolation are all that our civilization can spread over the earth. But in the last cultural epoch, souls who have accepted the spiritual in life will have become enriched, as if on the ruins of the external life of culture. Their surety that this acceptance of the spiritual has not been in vain will be the strong force of hope within them, hope that after a great catastrophe a new age will come for human beings, when there will appear an external life in a new culture what has already been prepared spiritually within the soul. Thus, if we permeate our whole being with spiritual science, we will advance step by step in full consciousness from our age of faith through the age of love and the age of hope to what we can see approaching us as the highest, truest, most beautiful goals of humanity. That's the end of part 9.